Okay, on page 126, we're going to look at just a quick overview of eye and ear. So on 126, we're going to look at some accessory structures. You can read down the list with me. Eyelids, eyelashes, a conjunctiva covering. These are all protective coverings on the outside surface of your eye. And when you're thinking about moving and opening and closing your eyelid, there's actually a muscle in there that you've learned in lab. What is the name of that muscle that opens and closes your eye? Good. Orbicularis oculi. That is your blank. We have a lacrimal gland on the lateral side of our eye. That is a gland that secretes tears. And I want to make a point about the way those tears flow. They flow across to the medial portion of your eye. Those tears enter one of two lacrimal ducts or canals, and then we flow into the nasal cavity. If you rub your eyes, maybe you've touched a dirty doorknob and didn't realize it was contaminated with a virus, then that virus now can make contact with your eye. It can flow, those viruses can then flow with your tears into your sinuses. And then the sinuses can become infected. You now have the sinus fluid, the mucus flow down the back of your throat, and now you have a sore throat. So what enters into your eyes can ultimately influence what's happening in your nose and your throat area as well. There's six muscles that move the eyes. They're called rectus muscles and oblique muscles. So they help you to fine-tune and focus those eyes toward whatever you're making, you know, contact with, whether it's up close or in distance. What I really wanted to spend a moment with, though, is at the very bottom of your page, the three layers of the eye. I'm just kind of slow down here and go through this in a little more detail. We have three tunics or layers of the eye. We have a fibrous tunic that composes the outermost portion. We have a middle region that's called the vascular tunic. That's rich in blood vessels. And then we have a deeper region called the neural tunic, which is rich in neurons. To be specific, these are photoreceptor cells. I'm going to detail those three tunics if you flip the page with me to page 127. The fibrous tunic is really a tough outer covering of your eye, and it's formed from the sclera, which forms the white of your eye, and a clear portion of your iris called the cornea. So these tough outer portions are meant to be protective for your eye. This is why we consider your eye to be one of those specialized sensory organs, because we have this connective tissue that helps to kind of insulate and protect those neurons inside your eye. So the cornea, you can see in this picture, is clear, it's transparent. It's also interesting in that it lacks blood vessels. So, you know, if you do a corneal transplant from a cadaver, then, you know, there's no risk of rejection or very little risk of rejection because of the lack of blood vessels and white blood cells that can make their way into that area. The vascular tunic is actually inside or deep to that fibrous tunic. The word vascular, what does that imply? Yeah, blood vessels, blood supply, good. So there is a rich layer of blood vessels right deep to that sclera. In this picture, it's colored yellow. And if you come around to the front side, there's actually a layer here, kind of what hooks your lens to the choroid. All of that is hooked into that vascular tunic. So as we approach this area, we've got some things called suspensory ligaments, ciliary bodies, and an iris, which we know is the colored portion of your eye. So I want to think about a trampoline for just a moment, because that's how your lens is hooked in with your vascular layer. So if you think about a trampoline, it's got the bouncy part in the middle. You've got a frame that trampoline portion is hooked to. And then there's probably some kind of wires or springs that hooks the bouncy part to the frame. And of course, you want those springs or wires to stay hooked, because otherwise you'll bounce and that trampoline will go down to the floor. So that's the way your iris and your lens and your sensory bodies all work together. Your lens is like the trampoline. When you focus up close or when you focus at distance, it's going to change shape just like the trampoline changes shape as you bounce. The frame that it's hooked to is actually this vascular tunic. And the wires or springs that anchor your trampoline are going to be these things here called suspensory ligaments, and they're kind of hooked in with these ciliary bodies. So when your limbs changes shape, we keep it hooked in place by way of those ciliary bodies and the suspensory ligaments right next to them. The older you get, especially as you approach your 40s, the possibility of changing shape for your limbs becomes less quick. So there's a delay in what you see. If you change distance to up close and vice versa, then you know you may need glasses or reading glasses to help correct for what once was very clear and very visible to you earlier in life. Okay, so then, of course, the iris is the colored portion of the eye. There's a wide range of colors here, but we actually benefit from having pigmentation to make the iris dark in color. What does the darkened pigment called melanin do for the rest of your eye?
Protects
it from sunlight, yeah. So if you don't have melanin in your iris, then you have a lighter colored iris like you see here, blue or green. But a darker pigment is actually beneficial to help protect that retina at the back part of our eye. So it limits how much light we get back there. Speaking of light, we are now reaching the neural pigment or the neural layer, which is composed of a pigmented layer and a layer that we call our neural layer. And so the pigmented layer at the back of your eye is meant to help capture light that hits the back of your retina. That prevents the light from reflecting back out through your iris, and of course the opening there is called the pupil. So if you've ever taken a picture and seen that reflection of red eye, that means that the pigmented layer at the back of your eye was unable to capture all of that light, and it reflects right back out at the camera. Normally, you know, we look at each other, I don't see anybody in here with reflective red eyes. That's because your retina, the pigmented layer, is capturing that light and preventing it from scattering back out of the eye. Okay, so the whole goal is to capture that light and let the neural layer get that light and send nerve impulse transmissions back to your brain. So in this picture, you're actually looking at the retina. The optic nerve is glowing yellow here. You can actually see the blood vessels from that underneath layer called the vascular tunic. But what we're really interested in is a little spot over here called the fovea centralis. In Latin, fovea centralis means focal point. Okay, and that's where most of your sharp vision is going to be sent, into that focal point. Okay, and there's a little yellow spot there, and that yellow spot is called the macula lutea, and that's where we're going to be sending that vision so that you can focus on items. That is what goes back to your brain and processes as sharp visual imagery. All right, so down near the bottom, there's a little bit of a pathway. I'm going to flip you on over to 128, and we'll incorporate that in this next picture here. So notice when light hits the retina portion of your eye, that's that layer that's at the back of your eye, light is captured by these photoreceptor cells after it has passed through a set of bipolar cells. You probably heard of bipolarity or you know, things of that sort, which is a different issue than this. Bipolar neurons are actually ones that have, you know, sort of axons and dendrites that are spread on both ends. So we're looking at two poles or two ends of those cells. Something not to worry about is just a different name for a type of neuron that sends impulses of light back to your eye. They're actually rare in the human body. So our goal is to get that light sent here to these photoreceptor cells. These photoreceptor cells come in two versions. They come as either rods or cones, and that's what's on the very top there of page 128. Which type of photoreceptor cell is best for bright light conditions like what we have in this room? Bright light conditions, rods or cones, which one is better? Cones. Yeah, cones are better. So in bright light vision like what we have right now, those cones will light up. And those cones light up in three different colors, red, blue, and green. The combinations, though, of how they light up gives us the variety of colors that we see. So cones are best used for light vision. If we shut off the lights, you know, just for illustration purposes, notice how your vision drops. In fact, shut all the lights off, and you really don't see much color anymore, do you? Okay, so when you shut all the lights off, your rods are now the ones that are responsible for transmitting vision, and they're not built for color vision. They're built for black and white, dark vision. So when we shut all the lights off, we really can't see what color clothes anybody is wearing or anything else. But what you can see in dark vision is movement. So that's why your cones are mostly located in this fovea centralis. Therefore, what you're looking at, what you're directly focusing on, while your rods are more towards your peripheral vision. They're the ones that are going to help you see movement. So let me give you an example. This is where we came from. Imagine if you were, you know, hunting at night, okay? You would not necessarily see the color of the animal that you were hunting, but what would you see instead?
The shape.
The shape, the outline, movement, yeah. So that is where those rods come into play. They're great for nighttime vision. They're the ones that help you see shapes, outlines, and especially movement in those peripheral portions of your vision. So I just want to emphasize, cones are for color vision. They're great in bright light conditions. Rods are for black and white vision. They're great at the nighttime when there's a very low level light or when we need to see movement because they're not in our focus point. They're actually in our peripheral vision.
So do dogs have more dominant rods?
They have more rods. They think they have less cones. Yeah, kind of cool to think about that. Just want to get you to the halfway point of this page and down there toward the bottom. We actually are focusing this light using a number of portions of our eye. Here in the front portion of your eye, you have what's called the cornea. That was part of the fibrous tunic. It's clear, it's transparent, it allows light to be focused on the lens. All right, so if you have a misshapen cornea, you have what's called an astigmatism, and you may not even realize it, but you have double vision. So that can give you a headache. It makes you feel like you can't see properly, but you know, corrective lens or contacts can help you change the way that astigmatism works. So as you pass through the cornea, right behind it, there is an area that has some fluid. We are now in what's called an anterior cavity. Okay, so this is about halfway down page 128. The anterior cavity houses a fluid called what? Aqueous humor, good. You ever been to have the your vision tested at the eye doctor? You ever have a little puff test put up against your eyes? Really uncomfortable? Okay, so that puff test is for glaucoma, which can cause blindness. And the problem is, if this fluid in this anterior cavity is experiencing really high pressure, it can cause damage to the rest of your eye. So that eye puff test, that little puff of air that they're sending over there to your cornea, is detecting how much pressure is in that aqueous humor. If it's too high, then of course they can do something, they can treat that pressure issue. So the aqueous humor is a fluid that circulates in your anterior cavity. It's actually divided into two chambers, an anterior chamber and a posterior chamber. So what separates those two chambers?
The iris.
The iris, good. Good. So the iris is the colorful portion right here, and it does separate the anterior chamber from the posterior chamber in your anterior cavity. All right. The lens actually serves as a dividing point between your anterior cavity and the big posterior cavity back in the rest of your eye. What is the name of the semi-fluid stuff that's found in the back portion of your eye?
Vitreous
humor. Good. So aqueous humor, A, comes first, V comes second alphabetically. So in the back portion of your eye, you have a vitreous humor that helps to maintain shape. Nonetheless, these two fluids also help to refract or bend and focus the light back here on your retina. Okay, so iris is, of course, the separator for your two chambers of the anterior cavity. The lens is actually the separator for your two humors. Anterior, of course, cavity houses aqueous humor. What does the posterior cavity house?
Vitreous
humor, good. Okay, so the lens is you start life with a clear, colorless lens. It is refracting light on the back part of your eye, known as the retina. As you age, that lens becomes more and more cloudy. Later in life, some people may need to have it replaced because it forms a condition called cataracts. So the job, however, is to refract and focus the light on the macula back here. That's part of that fovea centralis. That's where you have the highest concentration of cones. Are cones good for color vision or black and white nighttime vision?
Color vision,
color vision, good. So let's trace the pathway of light now that we kind of have all the pieces and parts in place. At the very bottom of your page, we're going to trace the light through the eyeball first. And then secondly, we're going to take that vision back into your brain. We're going to let the light first travel through this cornea. That's a portion of your fibrous tunic. It travels then through the anterior chamber of your anterior cavity. It then goes through an opening here we call the pupil. We're now in what's called the posterior chamber of your anterior cavity. All right, so what fluid is in that anterior cavity?
Aqueous,
good. All right, this now is allowing us to pass through our big lens. That is going to be one of the major portions of your eye that helps to refract or bend light. Now we're sent back through the posterior cavity, and we focus back here on the retina. What is the focal point called?
The fovea centralis.
Good. Yeah, fovea centralis. So ultimately, by focusing the light through the anterior vitreous humor and the posterior, anterior aqueous humor, posterior vitreous humor, we end up focusing that light back here on that fovea centralis. I want you to notice we're actually next door to your optic nerve, and the optic nerve actually has a region with no photoreceptor cells. So certain times you may have a blind spot where you actually can't see. If you close one eye, that's the only time you're ever going to realize your blind spot, when you're functioning with one eye open only. But if you have two functional eyes, they accommodate for each other, their fields of vision overlap, and you're never going to notice that you have a blind spot and that you're lacking photoreceptor cells. Okay, so once you focus that light on the fovea centralis, we're going to send it right next door to that optic nerve. And now let's take this vision back into your brain. All right, so this is going to be some familiar parts. These optic nerves that travel off the back part of your eyes make an X. At this point, we call it the optic chiasma. That's where those two optic nerves cross. We now are inside the brain, and we change the name from nerve to tract. Keep in mind, tracts are in the brain. We now travel to this relay station here known as
the thalamus.
Good. And we're heading back to the opposite hemisphere from what we started. So if we started with the right eye, we're traveling along the left hemisphere in association fibers. These association fibers take you to the back portion of your brain, which lobe houses the primary and association areas for vision?
Occipital lobe.
Good. So a lot of familiar parts here, optic nerves. We make a cross here at the optic chiasma. We travel through the opposite side of the hemisphere of the brain. So if you start left eye, we're now traveling right hemisphere. Relay through the thalamus. These association fibers take you back here to the occipital lobe. We first receive information at your primary visual cortex, and then we make sense of it at your association area. Okay. So there's a couple of things that I skimmed over and didn't mention. Some stuff on page 129. You'll just want to read through that. Okay. Just a little bit on the ear here, starting on page 130. So the ear actually has two different functions. It has a function for hearing, and it has a function for balance or equilibrium. What we're looking at in terms of external ear structures are for hearing. So this piece out here is called the auricle. Of course, we can see the auricle. It's a collection device for sound waves. And we're probably all familiar with this opening into our temporal bone known as the external auditory meatus. Basically, this is your ear canal. So when sound waves are captured, they are channeled into that ear canal. This is the external ear. And then they're going to encounter some more microscopic structures here in the middle ear. So when we get a little bit, you know, closer into this structure, our last external ear structure is our eardrum or tympanic membrane. And it vibrates just like the head of a drum. So it's vibrating as the sound waves encounter that tympanic membrane. As the tympanic membrane vibrates, it's pushing against three tiny ear bones. These are the tiniest bones in your body, and they're meant to be separate and able to vibrate because that's really important for you being able to hear. as those little ear bones vibrate, they increase or amplify what you hear. They increase the sound waves. So it's critical that they do this. If they ever fuse together and they can no longer vibrate, you actually are deaf. Okay, so it's that important that those little tiny ear bones vibrate. The first one we encounter is known as the malleus, or hammer. It vibrates against the incus. And then finally, we vibrate against the stapes, or stapes, sometimes called the stirrup. So the vibrating sound waves go first from malleus to incus to stapes or stapes. Kind of notice that that stapes right there has a, it's kind of sitting pushed up against this blue portion, which is our inner ear, and there's a little window up underneath there. It's called the oval window. So all of these sound waves come pushing against your tympanic membrane, and eventually you push against that oval window over here on the inner ear. All right, so now we're in a fluid-filled portion of your ear. Everything up to this point has been an air-filled cavity. This fluid-filled portion of your ear then sends sound waves into our hearing organ. It is this spiral-shaped structure over here known as what?
Cochlea.
Yeah, good. Cochlea or cochlea. Good. Either way works. I kind of think of it, looks like a snail, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and there's the snail stump. He's sitting on a tree stump. And that stump is actually vestibulocochlear nerve, or cranial nerve 8. Good, that's number 8. Good. So inside that cochlea, you actually have these little stones, you have these fluids in there, and I'm getting you to a different picture, and these hair cells. So these hair cells are sitting among a fluid, and the fluid inside your ear is called a lymph-like fluid, like endolymph. So when you are having sound waves vibrating through that tympanic membrane, pushing against those little teeny tiny ossicle bones, those push against the oval window of your inner ear, and those sound waves are vibrating against these hair cells. If the sound waves are loud enough, they will cause these hair cells to bend. That is enough to send an action potential back into your brain. If, however, you don't have sound waves that are loud enough, those hair cells don't reach threshold, they don't push far enough over, and do you hear anything if they don't reach threshold?
No.
So if somebody's whispering to you and you say, speak up, I can't quite hear you, then of course you have to reach threshold, get those hair cells to bend, that generates an action potential. Now, of course, we send that information back into your brain. Right there it is. There's the stump. That's that vestibulocochlear nerve. So that's what it takes to be able to hear. You've got to bend the hair cells inside your cochlea. You can also be deaf if your hair cells are ever damaged. If you work in a loud environment, such as, you know, near music, near, you know, airports, anywhere that there's loud noises consistently above 100 decibels, you can damage those hair cells. If they're damaged, you know, it takes a lot of noise to be able to generate an action potential, and therefore you don't hear unless the noises are very loud. So that's a different kind of deafness, totally different from those ossicle bone fusing, which causes conduction deafness. Okay, so that kind of gives you a brief overview of page 130. Do y'all have any questions so far? As we age, we do lose the ability to hear those high-pitched noises. It may be the cochlear nerve damage. You just don't send nerve impulses like you used to. Everything ages out. So it may be that they're just not sending nerve impulses like they were when they were younger. Men especially lose the high-pitched hearing. Women, they say, lose the low-pitched hearing. So we can't hear each other talk. That's why, you know, no one listens to each other.
That's why people don't
find it. Because they can't hear you. The ear always also functions in equilibrium or balance. I want to tell you about these other inner ear portions. Let me go back and give you a picture here. This picture shows us the cochlea, which we talked about already over here. They've cut it open. And here you can see it a little bit better. There's that cochlea. These little pieces here look like three little loops. These are what we call semicircular canals. Good. And in between there is an area that we call the vestibule. It is housed with a utricle and a saccule area. These are portions that deal with our equilibrium or balance. Okay, so on this slide, you'll notice that we have two types of equilibrium. We have what's called static equilibrium, which is what most of us are doing right now. We're not moving our heads, we're sitting stationary. And there's another type called dynamic equilibrium, when your head is in motion. One good way to think about this, excuse me, is when you're riding in a car. You know, if you get in, the car's off, you're not moving, you're experiencing what's called static equilibrium. When the car starts to move and when you turn corners, now you start to feel motion. So the motion that you experience has to do with the semicircular canals and the vestibule. Keep in mind that vestibule is this area here between the canals and the saccule and utricle area. Okay, so to be specific, semicircular canals are detecting rotational or angular movement. So if you're, say, on a roller coaster, a merry-go-round, riding in a car that's turning a corner, you can sense that your body and your head is moving in space. Even if you close your ears, you know this is happening. Kind of cool what happens. Take a look at these semicircular canals. They're filled with fluid. And not only that, but there are little tiny rocks in that area that slide with the movement. So if you've ever gotten off of a merry-go-round after somebody spun you like crazy, you didn't just stand up and say, I feel fine and normal. You stood there and were like,
You don't even stand.
You feel your head moving, right, for several seconds beyond getting off that merry-go-round. Those tiny otoliths are actually slinging with the fluid in those semicircular canals, and you feel a sense of motion in your head. People who are constantly dizzy with something called vertigo have these otoliths broken free from their location, and they may be slung through those semicircular canals, giving someone who's standing still a sense of motion. No wonder that makes you nauseated, right? And of course, if you're not in motion, then we don't need those semicircular canals to give us a sense of movement. They're basically involved when you're moving and your head is being rotated. Balance and head position comes from those utricle and saccule areas. That's the vestibule. That's how it is. That's Monday, right?
Oh, beautiful.
So that vestibule, that area, is helping you detect your balance and your head position. So if your head is upright, leaning down, those kinds of information are given to you by that particular portion of your inner ear. Okay. I'll let you read about the sound waves on the bottom of 131. I'm just going to pop you over to page 132. Midway of your page, this is where I wanted to get you. All right, so we're going to follow the pathway of a sound wave into the ear. This is probably a little more straightforward than the eye. We collect sound waves out here in the auricle or pinna. It is channeled through your external auditory meatus. Those sound waves vibrate against your tympanic membrane. We then travel through three little ear bones, and you've got a couple of blanks there, from malleus to what?
Incus,
good.
And stapes,
good, or stapes, whichever. Okay, so number malleus, and then go to number 5 is incus. And then number 6 is stapes or stapes. It does sound like a disease. You've got stapes. Okay, and then we vibrate against this oval window that moves the fluid in your inner ear. And it causes hair cells to bend inside your cochlea, which is a snail-shaped structure. And if we have an action potential, if we reach threshold and produce an action potential, we hear sounds. And that, of course, travels into our brain by way of our vestibulocochlear nerve. And this is, again, contralateral control. So what you hear in your right ear ends up being interpreted by your left hemisphere. Yep. So I think that one's probably a little more straightforward. Do catch that blank there for step 6. Vestibulocochlear nerve is the blank. It's actually up here. If you guys are interested in waiting for your test, I'll be happy to go run those and bring them.